Good evening, everyone. I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. In a report released recently, UNAIDS says an estimated 34 million people have the HIV virus globally. 18.2 million people are now on antiretroviral therapy. That's some good news there. However, women between 15 and 24 years of age are at great risk of infection. More than 35 million people have died of the disease since it was first identified in 1984. And over the years, scientific advances have improved prevention, treatment, and living with the virus. But many agree more remains to be done. Just before this year's World AIDS Day, which is commemorated every December 1st, South Africa launched a multi-year trial of a vaccine that might save millions of lives and help put an end to AIDS. Where do we stand in the fight against HIV/AIDS? What is being done and what is the way forward? We will address this on today's program. Joining me via phone from Cape Town, South Africa, is our guest expert, Dr. Olive Shisana, Chief Executive Officer of Human Sciences Research Council, HSRC South Africa, and co-chair of the 2016 International AIDS Conference that took place this year in Durban, South Africa. Professor Shisana, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward to a great discussion with Dr. Shisana. But before we do that, first, VOA's reporter Carol Pearson has the latest on HIV/AIDS.
A lot has happened since the first World AIDS Day in 1988. Back then, AIDS was a death sentence. The topic was taboo. Now there's life-saving treatment. Mothers with HIV can have healthy babies and live to raise them. And now, scientists are talking about vaccines and a cure. A major clinical trial of an experimental vaccine against the AIDS virus is underway in South Africa. The hope is to reduce the risk of infection by at least 50%. Scientists are also trying to use the body's own immune system to keep the virus in check. One study conducted by the University of Pennsylvania shows this may be possible. Dr. Pablo Tibas, an infectious disease specialist, spoke by Skype.
We infuse antibodies into the patients, the participants in the study, and we want to see if those antibodies would control the HIV virus, would keep it quiet and prevent the virus from coming back when we stop antiretroviral therapy.
Tibas said the research in controlling HIV with antibodies is similar to the immunotherapy being done in the field of cancer. HIV hides in cells. If a patient stops taking anti-AIDS drugs, the virus comes back. The technique uses antibodies, which are proteins, to attack cancer cells.
And when you think about oncology and cancer therapy with these immune-based therapies, what people are doing now in that field is to try to boost the immune system to eliminate the cancer cells. The problem of eliminating the HIV hideout is similar. You want to eliminate the cells that harbor the virus by making the immune system more active in finding and eliminating those cells.
Researchers found that the antibodies suppressed the HIV virus for 21 days. The goal is to find a combination of antibodies that can suppress the virus for 6 months to a year. Then people infected with HIV will no longer have to take medicine every day for the rest of their lives. A new trial using two antibodies should start in the next couple of months. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Professor Shisana, thank you again for joining us. Let me have first your reaction to the report we heard about the clinical trial that has been launched in South Africa. What can you tell us about it?
Okay, first of all, let me correct something. I'm no longer the CEO of the Human Sciences Research Council. I finished my 10-year non-renewable contract, and now I'm CEO of Evidence-Based Solutions.
Okay, thank you for the correction.
And secondly, to say that my expertise is much more on the prevention in the social and behavioral area, but I do have a good understanding of what's going on in the other areas. What I just want to say with regard to the vaccine that is going to, that is launched in South Africa, the HVTN-702, it's an excellent one in the sense that it builds on some of the results that were obtained in Thailand. And now they are expanding that information and using it to be able to develop a vaccine, which we hope it will be safe, it will be tolerable, and to be effective in preventing HIV infection, particularly among South African adults. So we're very happy about the fact that there are volunteers who have already agreed to actually participate in this vaccine trial.
That's great. And in terms of prevention, given that this is one of your areas of expertise, this is an important step, because since this virus has been identified in the 80s, people have had that one question: when are we going to have a vaccine? When are we going to be able to prevent HIV/AIDS transmission that way? I mean, of course, there are other ways which you could enlighten us further. But really, when it comes to vaccine, it has been the million-dollar question, if I can say that. So this is really hope. It's hope, really.
Yes, it's hope. And the fact that so many young people, you know, young adults are saying that, look, this is a solution. In the long run, what we need is a vaccine that is actually going to prevent us from becoming infected with HIV. Many of the other prevention methods have not worked out very well. Mm-hmm. So this particular one, they are hoping that is going to work very well. We all keep our thumbs up. We say that the scientists that are doing this study are really good scientists. Uh-huh. They have researched this thoroughly. They've built on work that has been done by others. And hopefully, arising from that, we'll be able to find a vaccine that really will be able to reduce the problem, particularly that our own country has got a very, very high HIV prevalence. It contributes disproportionately to the world in terms of the number of people that are living with HIV. And therefore, it's appropriate to test it here in South Africa.
But to what would you attribute this high prevalence in South Africa?
There are studies that were done, the phylogenetic studies that were done by Caprisa in the KwaZulu-Natal among young women, and they were able to isolate the bacteria, which is Prevotella bivia, which has been found to increase the chances of women to become infected with HIV. The first time that they've come up with a biological susceptibility theory of why black women in that particular region are more likely to acquire HIV infection, even with fewer sexual acts. So there is a biological susceptibility theory that is now, you know, gaining momentum. Secondly, the poverty, the levels of poverty that were generated over many years are contributing very much to HIV spread. So you have many young women engaging in transactional sex. And when they engage in transactional sex, they do not have the power to control with whom they have sex, how they have sex. And at the end of the day, they become infected because they have unprotected sex without any barriers whatsoever. So those are some of the reasons why that is happening. Poverty is a key issue. Inequality is a key issue. Uh-huh. And also the fact that then people then start engaging in multiple sexual partners, which many of them are concurrent. And in addition to that, they are engaging in sex not being protected. And that puts them very much at risk.
Okay. Now, this year, World AIDS Day focused on prevention, especially among adolescent girls and women. What is your take on the impact of HIV? I know you touched on that. You just did, actually. The impact of HIV among this particular group, whether it's in South Africa in particular or just in general in Africa, as we know that Africa as a whole is very much affected compared to other regions of the world.
Yeah, it's very much unfortunate that of the 7,500 new infections that occurred globally in 2015, and which are occurring within 1 week, 2,500 are occurring in South Africa within 1 week. Mm. So you're talking about a pretty high proportion of new infections that are occurring amongst young people 15 to 24. Mm-hmm. Now, something has to be done. My view is that these young women are going to continue to be involved in high-risk sexual activities, mainly because of the fact that they would like to get more money. And the only way they can get more money now, with the economy as it is to have multiple sexual partners. Now, the question is, can we moralize about that, or can we find another harm reduction strategy? A harm reduction strategy that would prevent them from becoming infected with HIV. One way to do this is to get them treated for this Prevotella bivia, this bacterium that we're talking about, mm-hmm. which is a vaginal inflammation. Get them treated for that and reduce their chances of becoming infected with HIV. Number two, we could get them to use pre-exposure prophylaxis. In other words, use some of the antiretroviral drugs that they can use before they engage in sex with a partner whose HIV status they do not know or whose HIV status is positive. So we're going to have to find some biomedical interventions that are acceptable to young women and see whether if they take that, they can indeed reduce their chances of becoming infected with HIV. We have to do something drastic. It can't be business as usual to say, we'll simply tell them, do not do this. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to listen to anyone who tells them they do not do this because the incentives that they are getting from these multiple sexual partners are large enough to take them out of their poor financial situation.
Okay. Now, I know some people have talked about one of the reasons being complacency, could be complacency, because with the sense that given progress, some young women and men are not so worried about HIV that much anymore and are not making the appropriate steps for prevention. To what extent do you think complacency is an issue?
It is a big issue. It's a real big issue because they say, well, you know, this is not like cancer. This is not like diabetes. I'd rather be HIV positive than have cancer or diabetes. Mm. This is the kind of talk that young women are engaging in. They are saying, they are evaluating the risk. They are saying you take one pill, and once you take one pill, you are okay. No one even knows that you are HIV positive because you don't lose weight like you used to do before. You know, you don't develop all the signs and symptoms that are so visible to everyone. You look healthy, you look normal, you are happy. So what's the problem, you know?
Yeah.
So there is a need to actually have a massive education campaign to get people to understand the long-term impact of having HIV, that they will still have a higher mortality rate than someone else who does not have HIV.
Yes.
There's a need for a massive campaign to educate these young people who did not grow up in the era where so many people were dying and therefore people were afraid of, you know, dying prematurely.
Yes. But how do we... It is true, massive education campaign is needed, and it seems that there have been campaigns everywhere, and well, again, more remains to be done. But how do we? Is there a problem with regards to the way the message is framed? Maybe.
Correctly. First of all, let me say that the knowledge levels, as measured, even around the world and even in South Africa, the knowledge levels are very poor. You know, very, very poor, meaning that people don't have really a very good understanding in terms of how to prevent HIV, you know, transmission. Many of them do not really understand that. So I think that's important to get knowledge. Number two is that whatever intervention is developed, It has to be developed with the young people, the very people that are involved in the behavior. They need to be involved in developing that intervention. It needs to be not only developed, pilot tested, and then even when you implement it, it requires, you know, that the implementation should involve these young people. It mustn't be something for the healthcare system to deal with. It must be something for the target population of young women to deal with the issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Professor Shisana, we're going to take a short break and continue our conversation. We really appreciate your clear explanation and expertise on the topic. So we're going to take a short break and we'll come right back to continue with Professor Shisana. It's time now for the news with Eva Yuma.
Nelson Mandela's dream of a hospital to provide specialized care for children has opened in Johannesburg on Friday. The 200-bed Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital cost $70 million to build. It was conceived by Mandela more than a decade ago and will employ 150 pediatric doctors and 450 nurses. The hospital is equipped with state-of-the-art equipment that will provide children-centered treatment for cancer, kidney, brain, lung, and heart ailments, among other things. The poor will not have to pay for treatments, according to the hospital trust. It says construction of the hospital was funded largely through donations from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Islamic Relief Worldwide, and the Kellogg Foundation. Specialist doctors from Canada's Hospital for Sick Children and Johns Hopkins Medicine International in the U.S. will be among those working at the hospital. Scientists say the regular use of cesarean sections is having an impact on human evolution. They say more mothers now need surgery to deliver a baby due to their narrow pelvis size. The researchers in Austria estimate that the global rate of cases where the baby could not fit through the maternal birth canal was 3%, or 30 in 1,000 births. They say the trend is likely to continue, but not to the extent that non-surgical births will become obsolete. The researchers devised a mathematical model using data from the World Health Organization and other large birth studies. They found opposing evolutionary forces in their theoretical study. The research is published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And finally, a new study suggests that a handful of nuts a day can lower the risk of various diseases. Specifically, the research suggests at least 20 grams per day of nuts can cut people's risk of coronary heart disease by nearly 30%, their risk of cancer by 15%, and their risk of premature death by 22%. Researchers say eating the nuts also reduced the risks of dying from respiratory disease by about half, as well as reducing the risk of diabetes by nearly 40%. Although they added there is less data to support the effect of consuming nuts on those ailments. The researchers from Imperial College London and the Norwegian University of Science and Technology analyzed 29 previous studies from around the world on the health benefits of nuts. The study was published in the journal BMC Medicine. And that's a wrap-up of the latest health news.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late on Health Chat, tonight we are discussing HIV/AIDS. And our expert today on the phone from Cape Town, South Africa, is Dr. Olive Shisana. And she was actually co-chair of the 2016 International AIDS Conference that took place this year in South Africa, in Durban. And Dr. Shisana, now let's talk about the issue of needs versus access. When we look at some regions where there is a need for treatment, needs for prevention services, but there are still a lot of people that do not have access to that need. So how do we close the gap between needs and services?
That's always a big challenge, in the sense that let's take an example of antiretroviral therapy, you know, which people need who are HIV positive so that they can reduce their infectiousness and we can reduce new infections in the country. The challenge of giving everyone antiretroviral therapy is huge, and it's huge because you need to have a healthcare system that's functioning optimally. We know many of our healthcare systems around the world, particularly in Africa, are not really good. We don't have enough health workers. We don't have enough health workers with the right attitude, the attitude that is not discriminating and stigmatizing those people that are living with HIV and driving them away from the healthcare facilities. So the access is controlled largely by human resources. The second biggest factor is financial resources. Most of the funding that most African countries get in order to provide antiretroviral therapy is donated internationally. We are progressively seeing many countries beginning to budget, you know, for HIV/AIDS resources. South Africa is reasonably well endowed. It does get money from international sources like PEPFAR, but the bulk of the money that South Africa has to provide for HIV treatment is still by and large from South Africa. Now, once you have enough resources, human resources, enough financial resources, then you've got to deal with the human rights issues. And those human rights issues become critical in the sense that there's a determination of who you want to provide the care to. If they are transgender people, people tend not to be wanting to provide services to them because they don't understand or they are discriminating against them. If people, if men who have sex with men are wanting to get services, they also get discriminated against. If they are sex workers, there is a morality issue that comes in and they are not able to obtain the treatment. So it's a complex issue. So we have the need, but the access is not readily available to people, even, you know, in the best of circumstances, sometimes in our own country, because of the moralizing that people tend to have on this condition.
And you touch on something so critical in this whole issue of HIV/AIDS that has been there from the very beginning. You talked about discrimination, stigma, a big, big problem. After all these years, people are still confronted with it. What is your reaction?
Well, I was hoping that now that we have treatment for HIV, we should see less and less of the stigma. However, there's another type of stigma that's developing, and that is self-stigmatization, what you call internalized stigma, where the person who has the disease doesn't feel comfortable talking about it because they think other people are going to stigmatize them, because they've seen before that people who had HIV were stigmatized. So they internalize it. And once they internalize it, it means that they are not going to do the things that they need to do in order to prevent transmission of HIV to other people. I was in another meeting with some of the people living with HIV, and they were saying to me, wait a minute, why should it be up to me who's positive to tell the partner that I'm positive? Why should I do that? Isn't that the responsibility of the partner to ensure that they protect themselves against getting HIV with me? Because if I have to tell them that I'm positive, it's not going to be good. You know, we're going to have a negative relationship, and the guy might just decide to leave and say, I don't want to have anything to do with you because you're HIV positive. So there is that. Those are the tensions that we still have with regard to stigma.
That's very, very, very critical. And the question that they raised is, it's really complex, because when you think about it, you know, they're making a point here. There is also the other aspect where, you know, one is to disclose whatever sickness or issues that they have. So what answer do you give in a case like this? What answer did you give them?
Well, first of all, I indicated to them that it is important that we all ensure we reduce the chances of someone else contracting HIV. I said to them, our country cannot afford to provide ARVs now to 7 million people, and that number is going to increase if each one of us does not take responsibility to prevent someone else from becoming infected with HIV. I said, I agree that the man has to have responsibility to prevent themselves, but you yourself have the responsibility to prevent someone else from becoming infected with HIV. Because as long as you other it, to say it's someone else who has to take that responsibility, I don't have to take responsibility, you are essentially saying, I can infect you, and you go ahead and infect another one and another one, another one, and I'm not contributing to the reduction of HIV. In fact, I'm contributing to the spread of HIV. So I had to be open and transparent with them to say, you still have the responsibility, even if the other person has the responsibility to prevent themselves from becoming infected with HIV.
So when you look at where South Africa is today, moving forward, where do you see as priorities, if we are to get, we have the tools to create an AIDS regeneration. So where will be the priorities moving forward for South Africa? Or where should be the priorities?
The priorities must be twofold. One is that we need to prevent new infections, because in the long run, we'll not be able to afford to continue to give the treatment that we want to give. Mm-hmm. We need to look at the evidence-based interventions that currently exist. You know, the pre-exposure prophylaxis, the post-exposure prophylaxis treatment. In other words, the drugs that help you to prevent getting infected with HIV before you engage in sex or after you've engaged in risky sex. We need to do that. Number two, I think we need to spend a lot of our time and resources to design interventions that change people's behavior that are developed by themselves. We need to go away from this approach of, I'm a scientist, I can be able to develop a prevention intervention, a social and structural and behavioral interventions for these young people who are the ones that are at highest risk. We must begin to say, let us do it with them. Try out approaches that work for them. Not the ones that work for me as a scientist, but the ones that work for them. We need to do that. And number three, we need to treat every person who is HIV positive. As soon as they are diagnosed to be HIV positive, treat them. South Africa is doing well in terms of new approaches of ensuring that people can get their medicines, because now you can be able to get your medicine at the pharmacy or outside of the healthcare facility so that they can be able to take on new patients. Because right now we have about close to 3.5 million people that are on HIV, and yet we've got 7 million people that are HIV positive. Mm-hmm. So we have to find a way of being able to accommodate the new people into the healthcare system by reducing the overcrowding within the healthcare facility and bringing in new people onto the system. But that's not easy.
Okay. And Professor Shesana, again, it was good to have you. We're getting ready to end the show. Very quickly, if you have a message of hope for those who are listening.
Well, I do think that the conference that we had woke everybody up on the question of HIV prevention. And everyone is focusing now on HIV prevention. The renewed energy on HIV prevention because of the conference, I have hope that is going to help us to reduce new infections in the future.
Okay.
And I hope that Africa will be able to manage this epidemic in the long run.
Great. Thank you so much, Doctor. Goodbye. And that was Dr. Olive Shesana joining us from Durban, from Cape Town, South Africa. I'm your host, Lino Mudu, in Washington, with Jackson Vugani, producer, and Eva Yuma for the news. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.